This is the Tax Update Podcast for September the 8th, 2008. This week, at death, do payments stop? Alimony Revisited. The Tax Update Podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research and confirm Ryan's Razor's presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and documents may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the podcast. Such prohibited use includes using this podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Leinberg Information Services, located on the web at www.leinbergservices.com. Leinberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.leinbergservices.com. Now, the tax court, when it issued the initial decision in this week's case, lamented the fact that it was yet again having to be stuck with having to decide and deal with a problem that could have been unequivocally resolved by a better drafted provision in the divorce decree, at least better resolved in terms of the spouse who was receiving the payments and the position she said the payments, the position that she was attempting to take with regard to the taxability of those payments. The court noted this case is another chapter in the long saga of cases decided by this court involving the failure of parties to divorce settlement agreements to specify what happens to payments should the payee spouse die. By failing to specify, the divorce litigants simply abdicate making a serious financial decision that others may then have to make for them, as here. The original decision cited above was the case of Johansson and Metzig versus Commissioner, TC Memo 2006-105. And it is a ruling the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals sustained this week in a public decision. The Ninth Circuit agreed with the tax court's conclusion that the applicable state law liability to make payments by default would cease on death unless the agreement held otherwise, even though the parties had not respected the same provision of state law when the taxpayer got remarried, an event that would have triggered the same no more payments required provision if the agreement didn't specify otherwise. We're going to look at the basic issues as well as the court's musing on the issue in general. Now, we've dealt with the basic rules for alimony in prior podcasts, so only briefly review here the basic requirements of alimony. The Internal Revenue Code is clear in Section 71B on the four requirements for a payment to be treated as alimony. First, key issue before we can get started is it means a payment must be in cash. It must be received by or on behalf of a spouse under a divorce or separation instrument, so we need the instrument there. The instrument must not designate such a payment as a payment which is not includable in gross income under Section 71 and not allowable as a deduction under Section 215. It must, in the case of an individual legally separated from a spouse under a decree of divorce or separate maintenance, the payee spouse and the payor spouse are not members of the same household at the time the payment is made, and there is no liability to make any payment for any period after the death of the payee spouse, and there is no liability to make any payment as a substitute for such payment, either in cash or property, after the death of that payee spouse. The issue that's given rise to a lot of court cases, including this one, is the final one. It turns out that many agreements are silent on what's going to happen if the payee spouse dies. In such a case, the courts end up having to look to what would happen under applicable state law in the event that this death took place. Would the payor spouse have to continue to make payments to the estate, or would the liability to make payments cease upon the death of the recipient spouse? And of course, as you might expect, the parties have different views on this point when the issue comes up before the federal courts, and since it's an event that has not happened yet, it's not really something the state courts are going to comment on because they don't have to rule about this till somebody dies and they stop or don't stop making payments. Now, the case involved former spouses John Weiler and Carol Johansson and the payment by John to Carol of $63,000 during 2002, so not a terribly minor amount of cash. John claimed the amounts represented deductible alimony that would be taxable to Carol, while Carol claims the payments did not represent taxable alimony. Thus, we're set with a normal set of events that triggers the IRS getting involved in these issues. Inconsistent reporting by the former spouses. Remember, the payor spouse does report the identification number of the recipient spouse. so the IRS has it within their ability to determine that they have a deduction being claimed by one of the spouses, no inclusion in income by the other, and it's time to get everybody together and let's talk this one over. Now, the agreement provided the following provision for payment of John to Carol. It said that John agreed to pay spousal support to Carol in the amount of $5,250 per month, beginning the first month following the sale of the residence, close of escrow. Spousal support shall be due one half on the first of each and every month and one half the 15th of every month. Spousal support shall continue at this amount through October 31st, 2010, at which time Carol's right to collect spousal support from John will permanently terminate. This termination date is absolute and non-modifiable under any circumstances. Spousal support shall be payable by wage assignment, which shall be issued along with the entry of agreement as a judgment. Service of the wage assignment is stayed unless and until John is 10 or more days late with any support payment. In the event John is ever 10 days or more late with any support payment, the wage assignment shall be served with no further notice to John. The agreement went on to further lock down the payment of these amounts by provision contained in the next paragraph, which provided, the duration of spousal support is non-modifiable, and the court will not have jurisdiction to modify the length of time John will pay spousal support to Carol. Specifically, the court does not have jurisdiction to award any spousal support payable from John to Carol for any period beyond October 31, 2010, regardless of the circumstances that may arise and regardless of whether any motion to modify spousal report is filed on or before October 31, 2010. The court also does not have jurisdiction to modify the amount of spousal support payable from John to Carol, except for two circumstances: John's death, prolonged unemployment, or John's disability. Upon unemployment, the court has jurisdiction to lower the amount of support for the length of the unemployment, provided appropriate efforts are being made by John to find employment. Upon John's disability, the court has the jurisdiction to lower the amount of support for the length of disability. Disability is defined as the inability to pursue an occupation because of physical or mental impairment. If such a modification is sought by John and ordered by the court may increase or decrease the amount of support as circumstances warrant, but under no circumstances does the court have the jurisdiction or authority to raise the spousal support over the amount of $5,250 per month. So we know what happens if John dies, but our problem under Section 71B is the issue becomes what happens if Carol dies. And it turns out the agreement was totally silent on that particular issue. At tax court, each party explained their view of what would happen in those cases, and views that, as you might expect, didn't really agree when they got to court, with Carol taking the position that the payments would not terminate on her death and John taking the positions that the payments would. As the court noted, John and Carol both testified in this case, and unsurprisingly, their testimony was contradictory on most points. That's normally the case when we see these particular issues in front of the court, I would note. The testimony of the respective parties was, for the most part, aimed at supporting, explaining, or modifying the express terms of the agreement. Again, a key issue that, in fact, the agreement was silent on this matter, so now everybody explains what they think the agreement means. Consequently, the tax court held, we base our decision solely on the terms of the agreement itself, rather than on any extrinsic evidence proffered by the party's testimony. Now, in this case, the parties resided in California at the time divorce was entered into, so the court looked to how California courts would view the above agreement in the event of Carol's death. Or, to be more appropriate, the tax court and Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals attempt to make that call on behalf of the California courts. Both the tax court and the Ninth Circuit found that Section 4337 of the California Family Law Code was a provision that was meant to fill in the blanks in these cases. And that provision provides, titled Termination of Support Order, Death, Remarriage, except as otherwise provided by the parties in writing, the obligation of a party under an order for support of the other party terminates upon the death of either party or the remarriage of the other party. Now, Carol attempted to argue that these payments were related to the value of her share of the value of C Supreme, which was a business that they owned an interest in. However, the tax court disagreed with that view, noting there is nothing in the agreement that remotely connects the $5,250 monthly spousal supports to Carol to her interest in C Supreme. I would note as an aside, if in fact they were payments for her interest in C Supreme, that would say they were property settlement. And if they were property settlement, then property settlement is not deductible or includable. The agreement recites, though, the court goes on to note, that John estimates the value of C Supreme to be in the vicinity of $1.2 million, that Carol agrees with this valuation. Since previous to the divorce, Carol owned 25% of C Supreme, the value of her interest would be in the neighborhood of $300,000, a far cry from the total support payments Carol expected to receive under the agreement. So the court voted both that the express provisions of the agreement applied, that this never suggested that this was payment for C Supreme, and secondly, the actual amounts being paid, as the court notes, the total stream of payments over its terms would add up to nearly $900,000, was far in excess of the amount they agreed C Supreme, Carol's interest at least, in C Supreme was worth. The court noted that the agreement indicated other parts of the agreement represented an equitable split of the couple's assets and liabilities, and it provided that John would receive the stock in C Supreme as a sole and separate property. So the court didn't buy Carol's assertion that this was a property settlement to compensate her for her interest in C Supreme. As well, it noted the specific part of the agreement where the 5250 payments are outlined are in a section of an agreement whose title clearly states spousal support and which carefully outlines the rights and obligations for spousal support of each spouse, clearly indicating to the court that these amounts were intended to be treated as such. The tax court thus concluded the payments constituted alimony under California Family Law Code Section 4337, and it would serve to terminate the liability on Carol's death. Thus, according to the tax court, the payments were taxable to Carol and deductible by John because all the requirements for Section 71B were met. Carol, as you might expect, wasn't terribly happy with this decision and filed an appeal with the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, who this week issued their decision on the matter. Now, the Ninth Circuit opinion sheds light on a few more facts that Carol believed would indicate the proper reading of the agreement was that liability for payments would terminate on her death, or would not terminate on her death, I should say. The Ninth Circuit outlines a test for whether Carol can escape the standard rule of California Family Code Section 4337 as follows. Here, the agreement does not explicitly provide whether Wyler's liability to make monthly payments to Johansson continues after her death. Under California law, except as otherwise agreed by the parties in writing, the obligation of a party under an order for support of the other party terminates upon the death of either party or the remarriage of the other party. A written agreement to waive Section 4337 must be specific and express, the court notes, quoting or citing the case of In Re Marriage of Thornton. While no particular words are required, silence will not do, this time quoting the California case of the marriage of Glasser. Mere failure to include death as a terminating event does not constitute a waiver of Section 4337. The court then goes on to review whether Carol can establish under specific and express intent to have the payments continue past her death. The Ninth Circuit does initially give some hope to a reversal holding, quote, however, where there is language in the written agreement reasonably susceptible to interpretation as a declaration of intent that support continue beyond death, extrinsic evidence is admissible to determine whether the written agreement waives Section 4337, this time citing the marriage of Cisnallis from California, finding that a non-modifiable statement expressly limited to the duration of spousal support to warrant such analysis of extrinsic evidence. In Cisnallis, the question was whether spousal support payments would continue in the event of the payee spouse's remarriage. Similar to the language in the Cisnallis agreement, the agreement here contains specific non-modification statements related to the duration of spousal support payments that are reasonably susceptible to interpretation as an agreement to continue payments after Johansson's death. Therefore, extrinsic evidence was admissible on the question of whether the parties waived the statutory termination of spousal support on the payee's death. However, the Ninth Circuit did note that Carol, under California law, would bear the burden of showing by clear and convincing evidence that the agreement was to continue payments beyond her death. Now, Carol noted that her former spouse had continued to make payments to her following her remarriage, even though the provisions of 4337 made it clear that remarriage of Carol would have been a terminating event under 4337. Her argument being that clearly, it appears the parties did not intend for 4337 to apply, and that John agreed with that because he continued to make payments past the point where 4337 would have allowed him to stop making payments if, in fact, it was a governing provision. However, the Ninth Circuit indicated that the fact that he continued to pay spousal support after she remarried did not constitute a written agreement regarding the status of payments in the event of Johansson's death. That is, merely by continuing to pay her after she remarried, John had not given up his right to assert that payments did not continue to her after her death. Carol also noted that originally the agreement had contained language that would have clearly terminated payment on her death, but that the language had been removed from the final draft. That to her seemed to be an action that explicitly suggested that that was not to be the occurrence if she died. However, the Ninth Circuit found this argument inadequate, noting the language explicitly providing for termination of the spousal support agreements at the death of either party was deleted from a prior version of the agreement, does not clearly and convincingly establish that the parties agreed in writing that the payments to Johansson would continue past her death. It would appear the court's view is that while you would remove that if you didn't want the payments to terminate clearly, it isn't necessarily clear enough to conclude the intent was not to have that provision apply in the case of Johansson's death. Rather, it sort of left the question open. Or at least it wasn't clear enough to allow the Ninth Circuit to override the tax court's original ruling on the matter when it looked at the facts of the cases. What are the implications of all of this to us when working with our clients? Well, the tax court indicated clearly its frustration with having to deal with this matter yet again. A frustration that is frankly understandable, given that it's relatively simple to draft the agreement to clearly fall on one side or the other of the Section 71 divide. It also illustrates the importance that clients understand the issue of whether a payment is or is not going to be treated as alimony really needs to be decided up front rather than shuffled off to the side. Inconsistent reporting is the thing that will tend to bring the issue to the forefront when the IRS comes calling. Remember again, the payor spouse is going to put that Social Security number on the Form 1040, and the payee spouse's return, therefore, can be looked at by the IRS to determine whether alimony was reported as income. So it's really not a good idea to have a vague clause that everybody feels like, well, I can interpret this as I want, because ultimately, you may find you're going to be sitting in front of the IRS, and the IRS is going to, not unreasonably, insist on a consistent interpretation for both spouses. That is, if this is deductible, it's includable, and if it's not includable, it's not deductible. It has to be consistent on both sides. That's the whole point of the reporting of the Social Security number of the recipient spouse on the paying spouse's 1040. Now, if the goal is to assure that a payment is not alimony, that solution is very simple, and it's one that Carol should have insisted upon if, in fact, that was the desired result and something that she had to have happen before she would have agreed to the decree as issued. That is, invoke Section 71B1B, which tells us in the negative how to assure a payment won't be treated as alimony. Remember that that provision held that in order to be alimony, the divorce or separation instrument cannot designate such a payment as a payment which is not includable in gross income and not allowable as a deduction under Section 215. Essentially, we just need to remove the not and simply have the instrument designate the payment as not to be includable in gross income under Section 71 and not allowable as a deduction under Section 215, and the result has been obtained. If that is your goal and you are representing the spouse who will be the recipient, then there really is very little excuse to not assure that result takes place by making certain that that language is in the decree. If the language is not in the decree, then we face the risk of the decree being treated or the payments being treated as alimony if it doesn't clearly violate one of the other provisions. Now, if you want a payment to be treated as alimony, things get a little more complicated. But nevertheless, the issues are not that difficult to deal with. Clearly, as this case points out, it is important to explicitly state in the instrument that there is no liability to pay any amount after the death of the recipient spouse. And to make sure the clause above stating it's not includable in income isn't in the agreement either. Now, the death of the spouse clause, death of former spouse clause, is honestly the one that usually trips these things up and why we're in court. If, in fact, you are making payments and you wish to assure those payments will be treated as alimony, you need to insist on explicit language indicating that the payments will cease on the death of the recipient spouse. If that language is not in the agreement, that opens the door for us to have to consider how a state court would interpret that provision. If you're a non-attorney or you don't practice in the area of family law, you may very well need to and probably should suggest your clients seek counsel as to what would be the result when you're trying to determine whether a payment is or is not alimony, if in fact the agreement doesn't make it clear what would happen in that case. But trying to make it alimony, you still have a couple of other hurdles to deal with. First, you have to make sure you don't run afoul of Section 71C, which deals with payments that end up being disguised child support. Child support is not considered alimony, and if your alimony tends to terminate on events that appear to be linked to the children, or basically events that would suggest we're terminating child support, you still can lose the alimony treatment. As well, and this is especially true for those of us who are accountants because this is simple math work from this point forward, you need to take a look at Section 71F and make sure that the alimony recapture rules under 71F won't be violated by the payment stream your party's agreeing to. The alimony recapture rules of Section 71F are really designed to be disguised property settlement catchers, but the problem is they don't make any reference to the fact or any question about whether you can argue these weren't truly property settlement. We just mechanically apply the excess front-end loading rules to the payment stream, and if in fact it is determined there has been excess front-end loading, we have alimony recapture. You need to make sure your client's not signing an agreement, at least not unless you intend for this to be the result, that's going to trigger alimony recapture. And finally, remember the basic requirement of Section 71B1 that the payment needs to be in cash. Now, it can be in cash either to the spouse or on behalf of the former spouse, but it needs to be a cash payment. Non-cash payments don't work. As well, it should be clear to you that this whole issue indicates that there are significant conflicting issues with the spouses in tax matters when it comes to divorce issues. Conflicts that clearly require us to consider Circular 230, Section 1029, as well as the other applicable professional standards to each of us who are involved in tax practice. The problem often is that spouses, when they decide you're going to get a divorce, come to the tax practitioner and suggest, well, we know you're going to be fair, quote unquote, and because of that, we want you to handle both of our returns. Couple of key things to remember. First, fairness is clearly a subjective standard, and you're probably going to find at the end of the divorce the parties have a very different view of what was a fair outcome. Secondly, there are clearly ways of interpreting alimony plus other issues in the divorce that come up during divorce that can have major impacts tax-wise on each party, and the issue becomes how do you advise them both unless you have conflict waivers in place and you've concluded that even with those waivers you're still capable and able to represent both parties competently, which you need to be able to do. For instance, some other issues that can come include the fact that all tax attributes pass and they split during divorce. That can be a problem if, in fact, there are partnership interests that have ticking time bombs within them, shall we say, where deductions have been claimed in excess of the actual cash entered into the partnership. There may be a repayment of debt that will reduce the basis of the partnership, creating a gain without cash, and whoever gets that interest is going to have that gain. That'll be a problem. As well, we need to consider the whole issue of filing joint versus separate returns and the potential issues that come there in terms of exposure to liabilities down the line. Finally, the issue down the line of having to deal with a potential issue where we're going to have to deal maybe with an innocent spouse claim by one or the other spouses down the line if there's a later assessment. All of these are significant conflict issues that really make it difficult to handle divorce cases and certainly make it clear that we need to have our conflict issues in place. Remember, under 1029, we only have 30 days essentially to get our waivers in place. Now, this has been the tax update for September 8th. I'm going to be getting ready to, once we get past the filing due date here for corporates of September 15th, I'm going to be going out and doing some more traveling here shortly. I'm scheduled to be in Roanoke, Virginia, coming up on the 22nd and 23rd of September. I'll be doing there a presentation on a technology update for those involved in accounting at the Virginia Accounting and Auditing Show in Roanoke. By the way, we repeat that show in November in Norfolk, or actually in Virginia Beach, Virginia, for those of you on that in that part of the state of Virginia. So we're going to be out there on two occasions doing this. I will also be doing a presentation for Fringe Benefits following on that Wednesday in Towson, Maryland, for the Maryland Society of CPAs. So you can consider going there if you're in the Baltimore area. As well, on September 30th, I'm going to be doing an advanced partnership course in Minneapolis, Minnesota, for the Minnesota Society of CPAs. And finally, as we get into October, in October on the 16th, following the, I should say, as I recall, it's on the 17th, following the due date for individuals, the ultimate end-of-life due date for individual returns on October 15th, October 17th, I'm going to be doing a current federal tax developments update in Casper, Wyoming. And the following week, I'm going to be doing courses in Sacramento, California, San Francisco, California, and in the Southern California region, one at Los Angeles Airport area, one in the Pasadena area, for the California Society of CPAs, dealing with those tax matters. So you may want to consider attending one of those if you're in any of those areas coming up. Note the California Society has now told you exactly where those courses are going to be, so the actual locations are now booked. So you can go online, check the actual locations for the courses, and see if those courses would work for you. This has been the Tax Update for September 8, 2008. The Tax Update, as always, is brought to you by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Be sure to visit them and take a look and consider subscribing to their newsletters for tax-related matters. This has been the Tax Update.